We are beginning this morning the third perek of Maseches Avodah Zarah. And for those who have been here, know that we've been very enmeshed in the in food production for the last year or so, and all the various kinds of Macholei Akum. And now those are gone. And now we're going to return to a study of a little more classic Gemara and a little more conceptual. A little more of conceptual interest, a little less nitty gritty. The topic of the perek, and it doesn't end with this perek, but it's mostly dealt with in this perek, is the prohibition of getting hana'ah from avodah zarah. Meaning, if you have an item that was consecrated, that was worshipped by an idolater, so one is not allowed to get hana'ah. The source for that, presumably, there's more than one pasuk. Is Psilei Elohim Tisrafun Ba'esh, you shall burn the idols of their gods in fire. Lo Sachmod Kesef Vizahav Alehem Alach Achtalach, you may not take the gold and silver on top of them. Kiso Avasa Shemelo Kechahu, because it's the abomination of God. Velo Saviso Eva El Besecha, you can't bring an abomination into your house. V'hayisa Cherem Kamo, you will be, I don't know, haram, I don't know what the word would be first. Verboten, you will be. I don't know how you translate cherem, like the Avodah Zarah, shaketz tishaketzenu, visa'ev tisa'avenu ki cherem hu. You should regard it as an abomination, disgusting, keep it away. So there is a prohibition of receiving hana from a pesel, from an item that was worshipped.
What examples of hana? Some specific examples.
Well, if it were made of gold or silver and you were to melt it down and to sell it, that would be hana.
If it was wood, if you
use it for wood, so I'll give it. We discussed this actually a while ago, probably more than a year ago. There's a Gemara in the second parak here and the second parak of Sachem that says Bakom Misrapin Chutz Me'atze Asherah. One may heal oneself with everything, meaning any avera if a person's life is in danger, except for Asherah wood. And Asherah tree is one that was worshipped. So there is a machlokas harishon in what that means. The Balei Tosfos say all that means is that you're not allowed to use avodah zarah, not the wood, but you're not allowed to use the incantations, the actual some element of the religion to heal yourself. Mm-hmm. But the position of the Ran, which is quoted by the Rama in Yoredeh and Simin Kuf Nun Zayin, is that the prohibition being misrapin ba'atzei asherah, healing oneself with asherah wood, means you're freezing to death, and you take this asherah wood and you make a fire with it to save yourself. And the Ran says you're not allowed to do that even to save your life, because not only do you have to give up your life to avoid violating avodah zarah and also the two other averos, but even what he calls abizrayu, even the accessories to avodah zarah, are also included in yehareg del yavar, that you have to better for to die than to actually violate them. So another use, if it's wood, so yes, you could use it as to burn for fuel in one capacity or another.
What if it was prepared, it was manufactured to be an avodah zarah, but it wasn't worshipped?
So that's one of the issues that we're going to explore is when does an avodah zarah become asur? What we're going to see, I think, lemaisa, I believe we paskin that by a goy it becomes asur as soon as it's made. The assumption, I think, being is that he will most certainly worship it. By a Jew who makes something as avodah zarah, maybe he'll change his mind and he won't worship. But we will explore these issues eventually. It's not an issue that comes up commonly, except for it does come up really in one context. In this country at least, if you were to travel to the Far East, you might have to deal with it there as well more commonly. But in this country, the question really would be various items that might be some way connected to, used in, associated with any religion that would be avodah zarah. And given that the general position within Psak is that Christianity, most denominations, certainly Catholicism, constitutes at least technically avodah zarah, even if it's not polytheistic in the classic way, but it's not strictly monotheistic. So theoretically, there could be a problem. One of the really interesting issues that's discussed in the Rishonim, there is a Mordechai, Talmud of the Maharam Rutenberg, who says that the tselem that they wear around their neck is not usher because they don't worship it. It's only a reminder. There is an old joke some of you might know about I don't tell jokes well generally, but I'll take my chances here about, you know, this poor Jew who can't earn a parnasa, and finally he's forced, the only thing he can do to earn a parnasa is to sell tselems to non-Jews. So he's terrified, and you know, he works in the store, he's got to sell them, and then the boss tells him to reorder, and he's just terrified. He's going to pick up the phone, here he's going ordering, and he picks up the phone trepidation and says, "Hi, this is a Yankel Goldberg said, I need an order of 50 more tzlamim. So the guy on the other end of the line says, mita tzelim or mita tzelim? Mita yoshka, mita yoshka. Okay, so it does point to a certain truth that Jews were involved, in fact, in the trade of crosses. But this is a discussion in the Rishonim. I think the Ramal quotes it from the Mordechai that they don't worship, and there's a very long Shach who pushes back a little bit. So at some point we might have the chance to explore that. But anyway, so that's why these issues do matter. It matters in the context of things that would be used in a Beis Avodah Zarah, decorations used in a Beis Avodah Zarah, art or something like that, so would be considered Noye Elilim, Noye Avodah Zarah, are also prohibited Bahana. So there is a whole host of areas where this actually does come up, Halacha L'maisa. Let me observe in this following context. I think Sam is referring to an incident. It's already a good number of years ago in India, right, where apparently there was an isser put out against the shaitels that came from India because apparently it was true or not true, I don't know, but apparently as part of an idolatrous ritual, there were women who would cut their hair for the Avodah Zarah. So here actually is a very important point, which is that there are two different Isurim that actually are dealt with in this context. One is the Avodah Zarah itself, and ironically, it's actually more lenient, and I'll explain in a second why. And the other is what's known as Tikroves Avodah Zarah. We already encountered Tikroves Avodah Zarah, that we dealt with at least. It was a major theme in the last parak, that Yayin Esach is what's called Tikroves Avodah Zarah. It's something that is brought as an offering to an Avodah Zarah. And there, the Gemara already learned from Asher Chelav Zvachemo Yochelu Yishtu Yayin Nesicham, so where the expression Yayin Esach comes from, that they are prohibited Bahana'ah. Now, the difference, however, between an Avodah Zarah itself, let's say there's an idol, versus the Tikroves, the material that was sacrificed, that was brought as an offering, is that Avodah Zarah itself theoretically has bittul. Avodah Zarah itself can be nullified. It's the discussion of a very interesting Mishnah in the next parak, of which there were two historical versions of the Mishnah, which the Gemara points out. Rebbe had taught the Mishnah one way when he was younger, and he taught the Mishnah a different way when he was older. The way we assume is that a goy can be mevatel an avodah zarah. Right? If a goy takes an avodah zarah that was worshipped, his or another guy's, and says, I'm decommissioning it, so then it's not a problem, which is why, although some people seem to have issues, I'm not sure what they are, leaving aside the separate discussion of entering a church, visiting the cloisters in northern Manhattan is not a problem, because those were pieces of medieval monasteries, churches that were taken apart, that were essentially, first they were destroyed in the first place, but they were decommissioned and made into a museum. So there can't be any Isser Hana per se in that context, because there was bittul. Even if you assume that originally some of the stones were part of a church and were Asr Bahana, but once those who were technically in charge, who could be Mavatel, gave it away to make a museum, that's called bittul. So there is bittul for Avodah Zarah itself, but there's no bittul for Tikroves Avodah Zarah. Once wine, let's say, is libated to an idol, nobody in the world can change its status. That wine is Aser Bana, has to be destroyed. So when you talk about the hair is ironically worse than the tzlamim. The tzlamim, if you know they're not worshipped, or even if they were worshipped, the guy is mevatel, so it's permissible Bana. But once something is brought as an offering to Avodah Zarah, there is no bittul whatsoever. It remains forever prohibited. Okay. So with that idea in mind, that introduction in mind, so we begin our parak, our discussion, and the opening discussion of the parak deals with what happens when you find a tselem. Now a tselem means literally an image, and it usually might be almost synonymous with pesel, which is a graven object or something like that. As to be distinguished from Avodah Zarah. An Avodah Zarah is something that you know or virtually certain was worshipped. A tselem, you don't know whether it was worshipped or not. So the question is, you discover this tselem, what may you assume about its status? So the first Mishnah begins which as follows. Kol ha-tzlamim asurim, all tzlamim are prohibited, mipnei shehein ne'evodim pam achas bashana. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir claims that all tzlamim, now the Gemara will talk about what exactly all tzlamim, but he says all tzlamim are also because they're worshipped once a year. That's Rabbi Meir's opinion. Now, presumably, if Rabbi Meir were factually correct, it would be hard to disagree with Rabbi Meir. But the Chachamim Omrim, Eino Osor, Ela Kol Sheyesh Biyado, Makel, O Tzipor, O Kadur. The only time in Avodah Zarah, the only time a tselem is assumed to be usur, is if it contains in its hand either a rod, a bird, or a ball, a kador, a sphere. The Gemara will talk about, give its explanations. I'm going to give an obvious altered explanation for one of them. And one of them I'm not going to explain now because I don't really know what it is. The Gemara gives an explanation, but I have a suspicion that there's something more to it. I can understand if a tselem is holding a staff, so presumably that suggests that it's something that has power. That's what the staff, that's what the mateh or the makel represents. I also think I know what the kadur represents. Which is the world, right? The Gemara doesn't say that, and certainly many Rishonim are not going to say that either, because I don't think they realize that the world is a sphere. It is clear from the Gemara in Pesachim at the end of the ninth parak, or towards the end of the ninth parak, it's a very important Gemara, that Chazal assumed that the world was either flat or hemispherical, but certainly did not assume it was a sphere. The Gemara there, in a fascinating debate, in which Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says he thinks that the Gentile scientists are correct and the Jewish scientists are wrong, there's a debate as to where the sun goes at night. So the Jewish view is that the sun goes underneath the firmament during the day and above the firmament at night. Right? Everybody has to explain how is it that the sun sets in the west, but the next day comes up in the east. So the path of the sun, according to Chachmei Yisrael, would be like this. And now it goes behind the rakia, which is solid, you can't see it, travels that other way overnight, and then comes out in the morning. And it's not, I'm not going to talk about it now. I think I probably touched upon this before, but this, in fact, that scientific view is necessary in order to adopt Rabbeinu Tam's view of Shkia and Seis HaKoham. Those of you who are familiar, there are people who wait Rabbeinu Tam's man, which can be 72 minutes after Shabbos. Chassidim may still do it, and they might even lean it on the front end as well. They'll do Malacha long past when we would consider it permissible to do Malacha. Rabbeinu Tam's whole view is based upon two sunsets, based upon the sun traveling the width of the firmament to get behind there at night. The Chachmei Umos HaOlam say, however, that the sun travels underneath the rakia during the day and underneath the karka, underneath the earth at night. Now that sounds a whole lot closer to what we assume to be the truth. And Rebbe says, here's the interesting part, it would appear their opinion is more correct than ours. Why? Because he says the hot springs are warmer at night than they are during the day. Now, that presumes either a flat or hemispherical earth, because if you assume that the earth is, if he understood the Chachmei Umos HaOlam's position as being a ball, as a round, then the sun is no closer to the source of the springs at night as during the day. Presumably, by the way, the reason he thought the springs were hot, they weren't hotter at night, but the air is colder, so when you step out, it feels like the hot springs are much hotter. But the bottom line is that they assumed that the world was either flat or hemispherical. But I think that the meaning of the Mishnah Kadur is because it means that the Avodah Zarah has the world in its hand. So anyway, the Chachamim believe that only tzlamim that have this particular, this kind, that have an object and these specific objects in their hands, only these ones are usur, but not others. So the question is, what exactly is the dispute with Rabbi Meir? Is it a debate about the realia? In other words, Rabbi Meir believes that all tzlamim are worshipped once a year. The Chachamim believe no, only tzlamim that carry this in their hand. So that the Gemara is going to explore. What?
Seaports.
I don't know what. The Gemara gives an explanation for all three, which is similar, but I don't. I wonder whether or not there is some other meaning to this. Probably, if you were to ask a classic scholar or someone who's much more familiar with Greco-Roman literature and Greek mythology, would probably have a better possibility as to what it is. The Gemara is going to make a suggestion.
About Sipor. Sipor was a known a form of a god because of the Egyptians. The symbol of a bird was very strong. About Sipor we have in the Torah.
No, Baal Peor.
We have Tzipor also.
I don't think so. But anyway, I don't know if that would have been Greco-Roman anyway. So the Gemara is going to give it. We'll see Gemara's explanation. The Gemara says that it controls everything like a bird. Like you hold the bird in your hand and they have full control over the bird. So again, that sounds like a drasha. So I don't know, but I suspect that if you were to probably delve into Greco-Roman literature, you'd find some type of an explanation. Okay. And then there's a third opinion. Yes,
okay, same.
Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Af kol sheyesh b'yado kol dar. No. Any tzelem, if it holds something in its hand, you're going to see the Gemara is going to ask some interesting questions about, what about this and what about that. Rabbi Shimon Amaliel seems to understand that if it holds anything in its hand, we might say it means it has power or control of some form. And those tzlamim are asurim. But all other tzlamim, meaning for Rabbi Shimon Amaliel, anything that holds nothing in its hand. For the Chachamim, anything that is holding nothing in its hand or is holding anything besides a ball, a bird, or a bat, we would say, a makel. So anything besides those three would be permissible. So again, the question would be, why do Rabbi Shimon Amaliel and the Chachamim differ with Rabbi Meir? In other words, are they simply arguing about the Metzius, the realia, or is there something else that's going on? Sam?
As a working hypothesis, couldn't you say they all agree with Rav Meir that they worship once a year, but only if they're holding something? Is that like a kind of a chetz of avodah zarah that could be ramped up to become a avodah zarah?
But
you know, even if it might be, they're all worship. Even if they don't have something, but only when they have something in their hand, does that become?
But
anything that they worship, does that automatically become a avodah zarah?
The answer is yes. I don't think that's a disputed point. I could take a worm, I can't do it, it's a bal chai, a dead worm, okay? And I could worship it, a shilshul, that's what the Chazal talk about. And I say, that's my God, and I worship it, and that's asur b'hanah. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't
have to be established religion.
You can make up your own religion. You can do that, and it's be avodah zarah.
One
of the things that we'll see in the Perek is that one of the indicators that sometimes we'll try to use to say something is or isn't worshipped is whether it's mechubad or whether it's mevuzah, whether it's presumably honorable. But if you know, let's say this person takes a piece of garbage and he sets it up as his avodah zarah and worships it, it's asur b'hanah. We just don't normally see a piece of garbage and assume that most people would worship it. But in principle, anything somebody were to designate as their avodah zarah and worship it would constitute avodah zarah and would be prohibited in Hana.
So, for example, the Russian icons, you know, Russians they have these saints, and
right.
They would not be considered
if they don't,
because they don't actually.
If they don't worship them, the answer would be no; they wouldn't be asur b'hanah. That the issue with the tzelem worn around the neck is the same question. It's really fundamentally what we call question of Matthias: are they worshipped? Are they not worshipped? Right? The Mordechai says they're mutter because it's just zichron ba'alma. It's right. Just to kind of remind them of his God, but it's not actually something that's venerated and worshipped. Okay, so now we're going to, I don't know if we'll get to all of it today. It looks like a very short Gemara. It's only about six lines, or maybe eight lines going out to the next page. It's a very, very complicated sugya. It's a fascinating, pedagogically speaking, it's a really interesting Gemara to do. So I want to do it properly, because the Gemara has a series of statements, and the question is, what is each statement modifying or commenting on? So for the moment, I want to open with just the first one and deal with a major conceptual issue before we move on. And then we will sort of jump in to figure out what the structure of the Gemara is. It's deceptively complicated. You know, given that it's about, again, 10 lines, you would think that this should be a sugya you just blow through. But in fact, it has with, I don't know if it's significant ramifications, because practically speaking, today, you just to decide what the halacha is, you look at what people actually do. So what people did in the time of the Gemara, what they worshipped, and what was an indication they worshipped, doesn't matter today. It all matters what people do today. But let's start with the following. First, the Gemara asks the following question. If in fact they are worshipped, Sam, one time a year, my time at the Rabbanan. Why would the Rabbanan disagree with Rabbi Meir? If it's an idol that's designated to be worshipped, even if they only worship once a year, they pull it out of the closet, you know, it's like the Hanukkah dishes, you pull them out of the closet once a year, that's still an avodah zarah. It's still asur b'hanah. Why would the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Meir and say that most tzlamim would be permissible? So, and the Gemara, as the Rambam points out, the Gemara could have concluded the question and say, if they're not necessarily so, why does Rabbi Meir hold what he holds? So, the Gemara quotes the following. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. B'mekomo sh'Rabbi Meir hayu ovden oso pam achas bashana. In the place that Rabbi Meir lived, every tzelem got worshipped once a year. It didn't matter how important it was, how important the God, how unimportant the God was. Once a year, every tzelem had its, you know, 15
every
minutes of fame.
Every dog has his day.
Right. every tzelem had it, once a year. So that was true in Rabbi Meir's town. Now, the Chachamim, and Rashi points out, well, the Mishnah doesn't present the Chachamim as denying Rabbi Meir's statement. They're not denying that Tzlamim, some Tzlamim are Nevadim Pa'am Achas Bashana. And once the Gemara says that in Rabbi Meir's town, they worshipped every Tzlamim once a year, it means the Chachamim agreed, that's true, it's correct. In your town, I don't know where Rabbi Meir lived. Wherever Rabbi Meir lived, somewhere in Eretz Yisrael, so everybody in that town, every Tzlamim was worshipped at least once a year. The Chachamim would not disagree that in Rabbi Meir's town, you were not allowed to get any Hanah from the Tzlamim. However, the question is, do you have to be concerned about other towns? So the Gemara says as follows. The Rabbi Meir, who assumes that everywhere you're not allowed to worship, take any tzelem, every tzelem is aser bana, is the chayish lemi'uta, gozar she'ar makomos atu osamako. Rabbi Meir, and we've encountered this once before in our Masechta, as a general rule was choshesh for a miut. The original example that the Gemara claims, Rabbi Meir never formulates this as a principle. He never says, I hold of a miut. It's derived from the following case. You have a katan or a katana, a minor, boy or girl, in the case of a boy, his older brother died without any children. And the question is, can the katan, forgetting what we would advise it for psychological and other reasons, is the katan allowed to do yibum on his brother's wife?
We have this in Hurricane.
What? Yes. Yes.
3.5 months ago.
Okay, yes. So I went to remember. I didn't remember from Parak Sheni, but in case for anybody else who didn't remember it, so I'm just reviewing Rabbi Meir's position. So Rabbi Meir, so the question is, can a katan do yibum? Now, why do you care? What's the problem? Let him do yibum. The answer is because it's possible the katan will turn out to be a saris, a eunuch. He will never reach sexual maturity. In which case, there's no mitzvah of yibum, and then there's a big avera of doing a violating eshes ach. Normally, a man marries a woman, his brother may never marry that woman, even if he dies, if he divorces her, unless he dies without any children, and there's a mitzvah yibum. So normally, when he dies without children, there's a mitzvah yibum. But if his brother is a saris, there's no mitzvah yibum, in which case, it remains in the category of ervas eshes achicha lo segale. You may not marry your brother's wife. So the question is, are we worried about this katan? We can't tell whether he's ever going to go through normal puberty. Similarly, for a katana, let's say a man dies without children, he's married to a katana, and let's say the katana's father married her off. So these are a real marriage minat Torah, because the father has the power, we don't allow it normally, but the power to marry off his daughter, and that's a real kiddushin d'oraisa. So the question is, can the katana, can she have yibum? Well, again, the same question arises. Maybe it'll turn out that she is an ilonis. She is incapable of bearing, not just infertile, but she's actually doesn't go through puberty normally. The Torah says that, and it's assumed, b'hayah b'char asher teled, to exclude an ilonis and a saris, that if she can't give birth by the very nature, not just that she's infertile, but she never goes through puberty, she is not eligible for yibum or chalitza, doesn't need it and not eligible for it. In which case, to allow a brother to do yibum with her could potentially be violating an erva. Now, what is the probability that the boy or the girl are going to be a saris ilonis?
We talked about
very small. Rabbi Meir nonetheless said it's aser. So the Gemara claims, based upon this, that Rabbi Meir, as a general principle, holds that we are choshesh for a miut. And the Chachamim are not choshesh. So Rabbi Meir, he saw in his town that this was a town, it might have been an unusual town, where every tzelem had its day. So therefore he said we should be gozer on all other towns, all tzlamim everywhere else. And v'chachamim, and the chachamim say what? Rabbanan, the lo chayishin the lo kasrus. They say sharmakomos atosamako. The chachamim say, yeah, we agree with you, Rabbi Meir. In your town, you're not allowed to get any benefit from any of the tzlamim because they are all aser b'hanah, because they are all worshipped once a year. But in other places, it's not typical that tzlamim are worshipped once a year, and the only tzlamim that are typically worshipped are the ones that hold these objects in their hands, and therefore we are not gozer, we are not chayishinan lemi'uta.
So the most important. So why doesn't the Mishnah say all that, or just even some of it, part of it?
So
I mean, why doesn't he say that in my city, it was worshipped? And but just
so,
to come off to start right off the bat to say, you know, called some asura, and the most important part is missing.
So let me answer. Let me answer with two observations. Number one. There isn't difference. There might be another opinion in the Gemara which follows. I say there might because it's not clear how to read the continuation of the Gemara, which we're going to hold off on a moment. Number two, I would say the following. It is not unusual. It is not typical for Mishnayos to provide reasons for dinim. Right? It's not typical. Usually the Mishnah states a din, states the ruling, it states multiple positions, and it, most of the... Sam, I understand. But the Chachamim, here's the key point. What pushes the Gemara into this, as Rashi explains, is the Chachamim don't argue on that point. They don't say they're not Nevadim Pa'amachas Bashana. The Chachamim just say only these particular things. So the question is, are they arguing about whether all Tzlam are worshipped once in a year? It doesn't sound like that. Or is there something else going on? So the language of the Mishnah itself begs the question, why exactly the Chachamim disagree with Rav Meir? That was the Gemara's opening question. If in fact, how could it possibly be? That's what forces the... Because unless you want to contest Rabbi Meir's factual statement, then and as a general rule, we rather not have a machlokas in realia. Because the assumption is that when it comes to realia, to metzias, go verify it, right? What's the point in arguing about whether chickens lay eggs or not? Just go look and see if chickens lay eggs. So in the same case, if Rabbi Meir says because they're worshipped once a year, unless you want to say the Chachamim believe that being worshipped once a year doesn't make it aser bana, which runs contrary to everything else in the Masechta, so you're forced now to find some other explanation. So either you say they disagree with the realia, or you say that there's something else going on here, that they agree in the Metzias, that some tzlamim, there's a group of tzlamim that are worshipped every one of them once a year. So then why would the Chacham disagree? The answer is, those are only these tzlamim. It must be the disagreement is, what about other tzlamim? Do we have to make a gzera on A because of B? So that's where the Gemara explains the machlokas between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir as whether chayshina lemi'uta. Now, if that's the case, I want to ask the following question. What is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel's position? Is he choshesh lemi'uta or is he not choshesh lemi'uta? If you look at him in the Mishnah, right? Rabbi Meir says all tzlam. The Chachamim say three different things in their hands. Rabbi Shimon says, if anything, in their hands. Where on the spectrum, where would you put Rabban Shimon Gamliel's position? Is he more like Rabbi Meir or more like the Chachamim? He's more like the Chachamim. In other words, he's just disagreeing on a detail. And as the Chachamim believe that we're not, the way the Gemara would explain, it never actually spells it out for Rabban Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Meir believes that because in his place, all Tzlamim are worshipped once a year, we should make a Gzeira against all Tzlamim in all places. The Chachamim obviously do not believe we make such a Gzeira. They say the only Tzlamim that are usher in an ordinary, standard, stam place would be things with these three objects in their hands. All other tzlamim are permissible. Rabbi Shimon Liel says, we don't make gzeira in all other places, but rather we prohibit only tzlamim with something in their hand, but all other tzlamim in all other places are assumed to be permissible. So it would seem that Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel agrees with the Chachamim that lo chayshinan lemi'uta, that we're not worried about a rare case. Now, this particular issue is a really, it's a crucial issue to understand what this machlokes is. And Tosos here was bothered by a question. The opening Tosos in our perek, Dibur Maschil Kolat Slamin. Tosos writes the following. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Af Kol Sheyesh Biyado Kol Davar. That's the quotation of the Mishnah. B'Gemara Mifaresh, Taima the Rabbi Meir, Mishum D'Chayesh Lemi'uta. The Gemara explains that Rabbi Meir's reason is because he's concerned about the miur of places where they worship all tzlamim once a year. V'gozar she'ar mekomos, he made a gzeira on all other places, atu oso makom, because of that place. V'rabbanon d'lo chayshi lemi'uta, the chachamim who are not worried about the miut, lo gazri, they don't make a gzeira. So only in a place where you know that all tzlamim are worshipped once a year are all tzlamim prohibited. Otherwise, only three types of tzlamim. Umashma mehacha, it would appear for here, the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, nami lochayesh lemiuta. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel also is not concerned for me. He just disagrees with the detail with the Chachamim. Upalig ad Rabbi Meir. And he argues with Rabbi Meir. Right? So we have figured this out on our own already. You figured it out on your own. I figured it out after I saw Tosos. But you figured it out on your own. Vitema. Tosos says, this is strange. The imkein kashid the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, Aram Shimon ben Gamliel. It means Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel contradicts his own position. The kasha hilchasa hilchasa. It's not just that. It's one thing for Rav Shimon Gamliel to contradict himself, but the way we paskin is contradictory. Tosis explains. The Rabbi Shimon Gamliel dahacha, our Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in our Mishnah, lo chayish lemiuta. He's not concerned about a miut, like the Chachamim. But uveperek im lohevi, in the Gemara in Shabbos, it's actually Rabbi Lezer de Mila, Tanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Kol Shesha Lamed Yom Ba'adam, Eino Nefel. Anytime a child has lived for 30 days, it's assumed not to be a preemie. Haloshah, if the child didn't survive 30 days, but kigon shenitraf, he was killed by a wild animal, osha achalo ari, or eaten by a lion, have nefel. He's considered a preemie, I mean it's a safek. Af al gam, derov nashim enam apilos. Even though most women who give birth to a child live, the child's not a nefel, the child's not a preemie, the child's going to survive. Alma, from the fact that Rabbi Shimon Leal says that only after 30 days do you know for sure that the child is considered a bar kayama, he's not a nefel, but he's a full-term child, you see that Alma chayish lemiut nefalim. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was concerned about the miut. Now, what does this mean, lahalacha? What's the difference? So one very practical difference comes in Hilchos Avelos. The Shulchan Aruch states that if a child dies, Rachmana Litzlan, within 30 days, there's no shiva for the child. There's no formal Avelos. Unless you know for sure the child was full term. That's the way. And once upon a time, they had no, today we would have a better way of knowing that. But once upon a time, they didn't know that. And therefore, if the child died within 30 days, there was no Avelos, because it was a suffix whether the child is a bar kayama. And certainly by Avelos, halacha kedivrei meikel ba'avel. Right? We always, by Avelos, whenever there's a machlokas, the Gemara says, we always follow the lenient opinion. So, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who says that a child is assumed to be becheskas nefel, and is assumed to be not a preemie, and not known to be a bar kayama until 30 days, he's worried about a distinct minority of cases of women who give birth to a live child, but the child is not a bar kayama. Those are the rare cases. So you see that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is concerned about a miut.
Why do you assume that's a rare case?
Statistically speaking, children born alive, I would say, who are not killed in an accident or some other outside.
Half of kids are born not full term, right? I mean, if term is date F.
No, so we don't assume full term doesn't have. Again, we only say a child not born full term is an AFL if he doesn't survive. Most children born, the overwhelming majority of children born
This is only in the case that the child died. So. If the kid died within 30 days, you're arguing, was he born full term or not?
Correct.
And I would argue that it's not such a minor case, given the prior probability that he died, it's not such a minor case that he was born full term.
No. So I would agree with you. If the child died on his own, then you might assume there was something there that the child can survive. But is the case where the lion ate the child, right? Okay. In other words, you're 100% correct.
I didn't understand the case.
You're right. The child that dies on its own within 30 days is a reis that would suggest that maybe it wasn't from the miut. But it's the child who seemed to be healthy and was killed just by an accident, right? So Rabbi Gamliel, Rashi Melech says you wouldn't sit shiva there, even though a majority would have been bar kayama. So is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel concerned about the biut as he is there or not like here? Now, Tosis doesn't say this, but I have a very simple answer to the first question, which is the stira between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. The answer is there was more than one Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. There was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel the first and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel the second. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel the first was the Gemara in Shabbos, and we learned this in the first parak in Avodah Zarah, says that Hillel v'Shimon b'no v'Gamliel b'no v'Shimon b'no nagu nisiyusan me'ashanim kodem abayis. Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, which is Gamliel HaZaken, Gamliel the first, and Shimon, which was the first Shimon ben Gamliel, or Shimon Leal, they were the Nisiyim starting 100 years before the Bayis. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is referred to by name by Josephus. He was the Nasi at the time of the destruction. His son was Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, Rabbi Gamliel Hasheni, the one who got into the fight with Rabbi Yoshua and embarrassed him and so on. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, this Rabbi Gamliel the second of Yavne, his son was Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel the second, who was Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's father. Okay? That's the way the genealogies go. So, for our purposes, I won't test you on the next week, but just know that there were two Rabbi Shimon Gamliels. Shimon, the son of Gamliel the first, who was the Gamliel HaZaken, who was the Hillel's grandson, and then there was Shimon Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne. So, there is a Gemara and a few places that states that Komakom Shoshana Rabbi Shimon Gamliel b'mishnosenu halacha kemoso chutzne orei v'tzidon v'raya achrona. This is a statement, I think, Rabbi Yochanan, who says that whatever Rashbag, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, stated the halacha in the Mishnah, we always pass him like him except for those three places. The problem is there are a number of suyos and shas, as Tosas points out, where it seems that we don't follow Rishum and Leil. So Tosas sometimes gives the answer, oh, that's the other Rishum and Gamaliel, okay? Which could be. But here, Tosos, here you could say, there's no stira, because maybe the Rabbi Shimon and Gamaliel's and Shas, who are Choshish for Miuta, that's Rabbi Shimon and Gamaliel the first, and here, where he's not Choshish for Miuta, it's Rabbi Shimon and Gamaliel the second. It doesn't work, though, and Tosos has set that up already, because even if Rabbi Shimon and Gamaliel is two different people, the way we end up paskening is contradictory. In other words, we assume, let's say here, we assume like the Chachamim or like Rabbi Shimon and Gamaliel that we're not Choshish Lemiut. We don't assume that all Tzlamim are Asurim. We don't assume like Rabbi Meir. And yet, we paskin that Kol Shalosh Shaha Shalosh Yom Ba'adam is a Safek Nefel. Right? So even if Rashbag was a split personality because he was two different people, said, what are we doing? How can we? It's Kasha. Tosa said, Hilchasa Hilchasa. That's why he told us two things. Mm-hmm. It's a Kasha of Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel. And it's also Kasha Hilchasa Hilchasa. Even if we solved the first one with the easy teretz, nonetheless, we're still left with a problem. So that's the question. Are we Choshesh for the meat or not? Furthermore, Tosis points to another Gemara. Utsna Nami, Perek Gimel de Bechoros. The Mishnah in Bechoros quotes Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel Omer, Halokeach Behema Minika Mina Oved Kochavim Beturim Mina Bechora, Deloma Rachama Ela Im Kein Yolda. The Mishnah says, this is not all a quotation of the Mishnah. The last five, six words are not explicit in the Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel says, this is the concern. A behema, a kosher animal, meaning cow, sheep, or goat, a female cow, sheep, or goat, its firstborn, if it's a male, is a karban. It has kedusha automatically. And not because you declare it as such, it's automatically, which, as you can imagine, is a serious problem, right? Because you don't really want to have, if you're a farmer, you don't want to have an animal that has kedusha floating around in your backyard. It's a bad idea on multiple levels. For starters, if you accidentally shecht it, you have to bring a chatas, right? You brought a carbon outside of the mikdash. And even if, and there are also concerns of me'ila, getting prohibited hana from hekdesh. So we don't like having carbonus around. We get around it by selling a piece of the ear of the animal to a non-Jew, and that does away with the problem of kedushas bechora. But in the Mishnah, they're not doing that. And the question is, you buy an animal from a non-Jew. And the crucial question is, did this animal, female animal, give birth yet or not? Did it give birth yet or not? Is it what's called a mevakeres, an animal giving birth for the first time when you see it give birth, or did it give birth already? That's the question. So let's say you buy an animal, and it's nursing a calf. Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel says, the chazaka is, you don't know for sure that that's this cow's calf and that it gave birth. You assume that, in fact, it gave birth already and the animal is not a mevakeres and the future offspring are not a problem. Okay? That's the assumption. Now, why is that so? So that it's clear from the Mishnah and the Gemara, it's because the assumption is that if this animal had never given birth before, it would not take a calf under its shoulder, proverbially. In other words, it wouldn't take it under its wing. Because it wouldn't have the maternal instincts yet. Now, what Tosfos points out and the Gemara observes is significant is, aside from the fact that the mother cow is taking care of this calf, there's another indication that it's given birth already. If it's taking care of it, what is it doing? It's nursing. Now, why would a cow be nursing? Why would it be producing milk if it never gave birth yet? So, the answer to that question is, it probably did give birth, and when you find a cow that you can milk at this point, it probably give birth. However, there is a minority of cows that are holvos, that can produce milk, even though they haven't given birth yet. Now, if they haven't given birth yet, if it's from that minority, then when this animal would have given birth subsequently, that animal would have kedushas bechor, the kedusha of the firstborn. So, apparently Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel believes the fact that it's choleves is not enough proof. It's not sufficient proof that the animal gave birth already. What's sufficient proof is that it's actually taking care of a calf. That it wouldn't do if it already hadn't given birth. Whether it actually is that cow's calf or a different cow's calf, it would not act in this maternal fashion if it hadn't given birth already. So Tosa says, what's going on? If an animal is choleves, in all probability, it gave birth already. Why is it important that it be menika, that it be taking this calf under its wings? Why isn't it sufficient for Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel to say that if a behema is choleves, it's already producing milk, it probably gave birth already? So that's what Tosa says, that it's mashma, avo mita'am choleves lo. The reason why Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel says that the mother is assumed to have given birth already is because it's menika, it's taking care of a calf. But from the fact just that it's cholevis, that it produces milk, that's not enough proof that it's given birth. The chalav ain't no poter. That milk in itself is not proof of the cows having given birth. The chayshinan lemiut cholvos. We are concerned about this minority of cows that produce milk, even though they actually haven't given birth. The hilchasa kaimalan kurabana de lo chayshin lemiut. We possibly like the against Rabbi Meir. So it's clear. Rabbi Shimon Leal says a behema choleves. So it seems right at this point. A behema choleves is not sufficient proof to declare that this animal gave birth already. We are concerned about the miut that are cholvos, that produce milk, even though they never gave birth. And Rabbi Shimon Lila says that within 30 days, we assume that a child, a human being's child, is considered an afel if they are, let's say, killed within 30 days, even though most children who are born healthy and look healthy, and in this case happen to have been killed by an accident, would in fact survive more than 30 days. Nonetheless, we are concerned about the miut. Now, that's the kasha of Rashbag Arashbag. What about the question of psak halacha? So Tosa says, the hilchasa kaimalad karabanan, de lo chayshi libiuta. We paskin like the rabbanan in general that we're not concerned about miut. How do we know this? De amrinan perakama de chulin, the Gemara and Chulin asked the following question. So let me give the background for a second. It's one of my favorite sugyos in Shas. It's like asking, how do you know that you have five fingers on your hand? The Gemara wants to know, we actually explored one of these. The Gemara wants to know, how do you know you follow Chazaka? And the Gemara wants to know you follow Ruba. How do you know that you're entitled to follow a Rov? So the Gemara quotes a pasuk. It says, Acharei Rabim Lahatos, right? When you have a court case, you follow a majority of judges. So the Gemara says, that's not sufficient proof, because that's only a Ruba de Isa Kaman. That means if I have X objects in front of you, and I know that 70% are permissible, then I can follow a Rove. But what about an abstract Rove? What about a sort of statistical Rove that's not measurable, sort of in a direct, concrete way? So the Gemara goes through a number of attempted proofs. One of them that they use as proof is that you're allowed to eat meat. Okay, what's the proof? Well, here's the concern. If the animal has a hole in its esophagus, that renders the animal a trefa and you're not allowed to eat it. Even if it's running around, dancing and prancing and so on, and you shecht it, you're not allowed to eat it, it's a trefa. How do you know when you shecht an animal and you go through the esophagus that you didn't cut it right at the place of the hole? And now when you inspect the veshet, you don't find the hole because you cut right through it. So the answer is, because we're not concerned about a miut. That's how you know. The fact that the Torah permits us, and not only permits us, but as the Gemara observes, one is not permitted to be an absolute total vegetarian according to Torah law. Because minimally speaking, you have to eat from the Karban Pesach. And the Kohanim have to eat the other Karbanos. So at least in a minimal sense, the Torah not only permits, but mandates eating meat. How can it mandate eating meat if you're choshesh for a miut? So that's how you know, azlinan basar ruba. That's how you know you follow a rove. So the Gemara in Chulin asks, but how did Rabbi Meir ever eat meat? The chitema that Rabbi Meir didn't eat meat, what would he do with the Karban Pesach? So the Gemara says it proves that even according to Rabbi Meir, hecha de efshar, hecha de lo efshar, lo efshar. Rabbi Meir's choshesh lemiuta only when it's possible. When it becomes essentially impossible, in that case you couldn't do the mitzvah of eating, even Rabbi Meir admits that lo chayshin lemiuta, which would suggest that it's only within the Rabbanan, which it probably is according to Rabbi Meir. Now, but that's not our interest. What is our interest? Satosa says the following. A behilchasa, the psak is that kaimalan karavana de lochayishlemi uta, damrinam perakam de chulen, virabi meir de chayishlemi uta, hechi ochal bisra. That's what the Gemara says. Rabbi Meir, who's choshishlemi, how did he eat meat? Ubin de lo kaamar, hechi achlinan. In fact, the Gemara doesn't say, how do we eat meat? From that mashma the kaimalan de lochayishin and the miuta. That's how you know we don't hold like Rabbi Meir. The Gemara's kasha was not, how do we eat meat? Sometimes the Gemara will ask such a question, how do we do this? But the Gemara says, only has Rabbi Meir eat meat, means we don't hold like Rabbi Meir. It means if we don't hold like Rabbi Meir, it means we are not choshish l'miuta. Now it happens to be in the maskana, even Rabbi Meir eats meat, but the point is the way the Gemara formulates it makes it clear that it was never a kasha on us. It was only a kasha on Rabbi Meir, and therefore you know we paskin lo chayishin and l'miuta. And yet Tosfos says, the ilu bebechoros uvenefel, the case of the behema cholaves, and by anefel, paskinat k'Rabbi Shimon Gamliel d'chayish lemiuta. We paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So how do you, even if you say it's to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, or even if you're not concerned about what was Rabbi, how to resolve Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, it's a problem for us. How do we adopt a position, or to borrow the famous expression the Gemara has at the end of the fourth parak in Gittin, how can we establish our and defend our position when we are adopting mutually exclusive positions? That's Tosfos' question. So Tosfos says the following. V'yesh lomar, devadai Rabbi Shimon Gamliel lo chayish lemimuta k'demash v'hachi. You know what? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel doesn't hold like Rabbi Meir in those other Gemaras. He paskins lo chayishin lemimuta, like we say here. V'ahi d'nefel shani. You know why by nefel he's choshesh? D'havai d'humiut hamatzui. D'nefalim shchichi. V'sham v'atayesh lachosh. So Tosu says, no, there are actually three categories in halacha. There's rov, not three categories. There's a miut hamatzoi, and there's a miut she'eno matzoi. There are two kinds of miuts. There's the case of the improbable. Improbable could just mean that it's less than 50%, but improbable could also mean it's highly improbable, or it could be less probable, but nonetheless not so uncommon. So there's something called a miut hamatzoi, and there's something called a miut she'eno matzoi. The machlokes Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is over a miut she'eno matzoi, if it's a very rare miut. Where Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is choshesh for miut, and maybe the Rabbanu would too, is by a miut hamatzoi. Now, of course, this is a very convenient categorization. Rabbi Feldman is smiling at me and say, okay, how do you tell the difference between a miut hamatzoi and a miut she'eno matzoi? A common rule of thumb that posts can give, but it is somewhat arbitrary, is like 10%. They say less than 10% is a miut she'eno matzoi, more than 10% is a miut hamatzoi. Obviously, it is somewhat arbitrary. Conceptually, it's an appealing concept. Practically speaking, implementing, deciding where you draw the line is not quite as easy. But that's what Tosa says, that Rav Shimon Leal does not hold like Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is choshesh even for miut she'eno matzoi whenever possible. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel holds that you're only choshesh for miut hamatzoi. All other places worshipping all tzlamim is a miut she'eno matzoi. And nekev, b'makom avesha, b'makom ashchita, is a miut she'eno matzoi. In Ailonis and Asaris, by a katan rektana for yibum, is a miut she'eno matzoi. But nefalim, that's a miut hamatzoi, and therefore we're choshesh for it. And similarly, Tosa says the following. And it's proof of this is kidamrinon gabe ra'uhu nofel lamayim she'en lamsof o ra'u goses to ishto asura afal pisharov goses in lamisa. If they left a person, a man who was terminally ill, he was sort of in a mortal peril, like goses, he was redlining or something like that. But they bring a lot of people back from that. Right, so most people die when they go into that state, but there is certainly a significant number of people that are able to save. It's not terminally ill would mean that we'd say 100% he's going to die, he's got a terminal illness. It may take X number of months. But a goses, we say, is rov goses in lamisa, but there are those who survive and get perfectly better. So Tosa says that the Gemara says if they saw a man's wife, a woman's husband, goses, they can't testify that he died. Aval pisha rov goses in lamisa, most will die. V'chayshin in lamiyuta, why? Mibneshu miyut hamatzoi. Now what about the Gemara in Bechoros? How common is it for a cow? And this will go back to Josh's point earlier, conceptually, the question you asked. How common is it for a cow to be producing milk before it's given birth? You would think that's a miut she'eno matzoi, and that in itself, the fact that it produces milk should be proof that it gave birth. Why is he choshesh for the miut shechovos afal pi she'enon yoldos? Satosa says, v'ahi de bechoros mayri she'reinu choleves kodem leida. No, it's talking about a cow which is nursing a calf now, but we know that this cow actually was producing milk even before it gave birth. In which case, the vaday hochsuka min amiut. In other words, that's not a case really of a suffix. That's a case where we know that this cow milked before it gave birth. And therefore, it's not a suffix. It's not that we're being choshesh for an uncommon miut. It's precisely, the question is, we know this cow was producing milk even before it gave birth. Now you see this cow nursing a calf. And the question is, the fact that it's taken a calf under its wing, is that sufficient proof that it actually gave birth to this calf or a different calf? And that's Rabbi Shimon's point. That in a case where the animal we know produced milk before it gave birth, so it's not even a question of a suffix, that the chaliva is certainly not a proof of the animal having become a mother already. But now it's taking care of a calf. Rabbi Shimon Leal says that's enough of a proof. It would not be merachama. It would not have compassion and take this calf under its wing if it all actually hadn't already given birth. But Tosu says, avovadai b'sher behemos chalapoter. Any other animal, when you don't know whether it gave birth or not, and all you see is that it's producing milk, of course Rabbi Shimon Leal would say it's patam and habachor. Of course you would assume that it already gave birth. V'chein halacha. That's how Tosus concludes. That latter part is a major, that's a big ukimta in the Gemara and Bechor. That's a significant qualification. It totally turns things on its head. In other words, what sounds like from the Gemara is that nursing is proof, but producing milk is not proof. Now we're saying, no, producing milk is also proof. When we say that nursing is proof, it means nursing where the milk is not proof because you know it produced milk before it gave birth. Quite a qualification of that Mishnah. But that's the way Tosos solves the problem in Bechoros. So the bottom line in Tosos is, despite what appears to be a contradiction between Rabban Shimon Gamliel and Rabban Shimon Gamliel and halacha, it's not true. The basic principle is that if you hold like Rabbi Meir, which we don't, you're choshesh for a miut whenever possible, even though it's a miut she'eno matzoi. It's extremely uncommon. We paskin that you're not choshesh for a miut she'eno matzoi, but we are concerned about a miut hamatzoi. And therefore, that would explain why Rabban Shimon Gamliel is choshesh for a nefel, and why we are choshesh for a nefel by a vlad that was killed within 30 days. Okay, so that is the way the Gemara presents the Machlokas, Rabbi Meir, and the Chachamim. I want to just conclude a couple of minutes to present the opening part of the Gemara to sort of highlight what the problem is, what the difficulty is, and then sort of come back to next week to explore the various ways that we show and read the Gemara. Before we read the Gemara, I want to just look at the next Mishnah on Daf Aleph Amud Aleph. Don't turn the page, just turn your head. So look left. And the Mishnah on the second wide line says the following: Hamotze shivrei tzlamim, harei elu mutarim. If you find broken tzlamim, they are permissible. One is permitted to get benefit from them. Now, why should that? What kinds of tzlamim are we talking about here? After all, let's say they weren't broken. Let's say they were straight up tzlamim. What would the din be? So right now, if you find it tzlamim normally, is it asur or is it mutar? It's normally assumed to be mutar, unless, for the Chachamim, it's holding one of three things in its hand. The Mishnah implies that if you find broken tzlamim, they're mutar. The implication is if you find them whole, we may contest this point, but if you find them whole, they're asur. So which tzlamim are we talking about here? Rabbi Meir, right? So Rabbi Meir, it could say it's Rabbi Meir, because he's choshesh all tzlamim, or you could say right now, for this line in the Mishnah, that if you find shivrei tzlamim, which are still holding that ball in their hand, or that staff in their hand, that it's even talking about according to the Chachamim, that if you find them broken, that's a different story. Okay? Now, just I'm going to sort of cheat and explain to you why would the fact that they're broken make a difference. So the answer is that either at Avodah Zarah, when it is broken, it is automatically assumed to be batel, because any guy would once it's broken would no longer worship it, or because the fact that it's broken indicates that the guy broke it on purpose and he wasn't interested in it anymore. So the assumption is that when you find it broken, there's another element of suffix here. Forgetting it might not have been worshipped in the first place, but also even if it were worshipped, they might have been mevatel, and the proof is that it's broken. Okay, so whichever tzlamim we're talking about, it could be Rabbi Meir, it could be the Chacham right now. But here's the tricky part: Matzah tavnis yad or tavnis regel. Let's say you find the image of a hand or a foot, and the Gemara is going to ask a question about this. But the simple reading of the Mishnah, it's kind of obvious. Is it's not that you find a broken hand or a foot broken off. You find an idol where you can see the idol was an etzelim was a hand, the etzelim was a foot. So the Mishnah says, Matzah tavnis yad or tavnis regel, harei elu asurim, it's prohibited, nipnei shechayotze b'hoim nevad, because such things are in fact worshipped. In other words, it's one thing when you get a whole person, a whole image, and it's broken, and all you're left with is a hand and a foot, versus when you find something that was made that way in the first place. Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to ask the question, whose opinion is this? It's a crucial, crucial question. Because certainly, for the Chachamim, and maybe the hand is holding a ball, and it doesn't sound like from the Mishnah, right? And the Regel certainly not holding something in it. So that the question is, how does this Mishnah work with our Mishnah? So keep that question in the back of your mind. But now the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says as follows, going back to Mem Amud Beis, the second line from the bottom. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Now the first word there is Amar, is a really important word. If that word is not there, it theoretically changes the entire complexion of the Gemara. I would argue that Rashi actually doesn't have the word Amar. What's the difference between whether it says Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel versus
Rav Yehuda Amar?
I don't know how Rav Yehuda Omer Shmuel Amar. Be'andarti shel malachim shaninu. The difference between Amar Rav Ploni and Rav Ploni Amar. Amar Rav Ploni is a new statement. Rav Ploni Amar is arguing on the previous statement. It's a distinction that we show and point out here and point out in a number of places. Right? The crucial order of the words tells you whether it's a follow-up and a dispute with what came before. In other words, such and such, Rav Omer the following. Ushmuel Amar, but Shmuel says X. Or Shmuel Amar is a new statement.
You mean Amar Shmuel?
Oh, no, Amar. Amar Shmuel's a new statement. Correct. I'm sorry. Shmuel Amar is that Shmuel says something different. Which one?
Shmuel Amar means Shmuel had said.
Yes, you could. Maybe. So I'll accept that for the moment. This is a. You don't have to say had said. In other words, firstly, Amar. It depends whether it's Aramaic or Hebrew. It may be present tense. You could say, and Shmuel says. Either way.
I apologize, I missed a turn. I thought that what you just explained and asked us to be careful about is that when the verb appears after the name, you know that they're quoting an existing position and statement, whereas when the verb appears before the name, they're beginning with a new pronouncement.
No, it's not. When I say, either way, the statement is new to us. But the question is it being presented as conflicting with what came before, or is not conflicting? It could be a new topic, it could be a new subtopic. In other words, when you get a statement like, when you have a statement, an explanation of Rav, the following, and then you have a statement that, you know, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, that is not arguing what Rav said. It's addressing something different.
It's not temporal.
Not at all. It's a question of where the emphasis is on, right? Is it on what he said? That's not a good way of saying it. But in other words, you might even say, is there a but implied? Shmuel Amar is a but. In other words, Rav said this, but Shmuel said the following. So the question is Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel arguing on what came before, or is this addressing something different? So Rashi writes, he doesn't state as explicitly as we would like. Well, let's read the statement first. Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel, be'andarti shel malachim shaninu. Shaninu means we have taught the Mishnah. It was taught with respect to some type of honorary statue for a king. Now the question is, when he says the Mishnah was talking about Andarti Shamalachim, who in the Mishnah was talking about Andarti Shamalachim? And then, let's read the next statement. Amar Rabba Bar Bar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Uva'omdim al Pesach Medina Shaninu. So the way it's presented, Rabbi Bar Chanan Rabbi Yochanan is qualifying Shmuel's statement, not arguing, but he's saying Shmuel said that the Mishnah is specifically by an Andarti Shamalachim, some statue of a king, and specifically when it's standing at the entrance to the city. So right now, the way our Gemara is presented is Shmuel and Rabbi Chanan Rabbi Yochanan are not arguing, it's not a machlokes, but one is qualifying the other, and the question still remains, who are they qualifying? So Rashi, right, if you look at Rashi writes Andarti, the second to last Rashi on the Amud, Kisha Hamelech Meis Osin Suraso v'Pesach Hashar Lezikaron. When a king dies, they make a statue of him at the city gate as a commemoration. V'Hosam Ka'asa Rabbi Meir. That's where Rabbi Meir prohibits the Agav Chavivusa Polchile, because it's so precious to them, they worship it. And then, specifically by those Rabbi Meir prohibits. So the way Rashi understood these two statements is that, in effect, they're arguing on what came before. Rabbi Yochanan, as quoted by Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, said only that Rabbi Meir asked really all tzlamim. Why? Because in his city, every tzlam was worshipped once a year. And then comes along Shmuel, and a different version of Rabbi Yochanan says, no, Rabbi Meir didn't prohibit all tzlamim. It doesn't seem to be about choshei shlemiut, or even if it is, in Rabbi Meir's city, the only psilim, the only tzlamim he thought that were universally worshipped were an andarti shel malachim, and when they were standing al Pesach HaMedina. And those Rabbi Meir is much more lenient than the way the first reading of Rabbi Meir. That is the way Rashi understands this Gemara. Now, there's one more line in the Gemara going over to the next Amud. Amar Rabba, in fact, I'm going to skip to the fifth line, because the Gemara presents Rabba one way and then rejects it and presents him a different way. Amar Rabba, five lines from the top, Machlokis Beshel Krachim, the whole debate, presumably the debate between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, is only in big cities. Aval b'shel kfarim divrei hakol asurim. In a small town, a certain kind of avodah zarah, I don't know which it is, which tzlamim, are always worshipped. In other words, in the big city, they have artwork. In the small towns, they don't have a budget for artwork and for things like that. So in a small town, when you find a tzlamim, of course everybody agrees they're worshipped. Okay, which tzlamim? Is it all tzlamim? Is it the tzelem which is holding? Is it the andarti al pesach hamedina? And so on and so forth. That's the question that's to be explored. That's the way Rashi reads. We haven't explained Rashi yet on this part, but the way Rashi reads the Gemara is that these two statements are of Shmuel and the other Rabbi Yochanan statement are arguing in the first Rabbi Yochanan presentation. They're arguing within Rabbi Meir. However, the last thing I'll point out to you, if you look on the bottom, small print, Hagos Hagra, there's a little Aleph on the bottom line of Mem Amud Beis in the Gemara, right before Amar Rabba Bar Chana. And if you look in the Hagos Hagra, the Gra writes, Amar Rabba Rachana, Nira Nenimtza Betzido, or Nira Be'enai, Girsas HaRambam, Rabba Bar Barchana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. The Gra says that it would appear that the Girsa of the Rambam is doesn't have the first word Amar. Why did the Gra take out the word Amar? Because when we look at the sheet of the Rambam next week, you see the Rambam has a totally different relationship between Shmuel and Rabba Barchana's statement, which makes it clear that the Rambam must have had a different Gersa. So there are probably at least four different ways that the Rishonim put together the pieces in this Gemara, which is what we're going to try to explore next week.
I have to press home to unlock. You have to unlock it and then
okay. Uh-oh.